WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 1, Episode 8 of Pulse of the Nation, the podcast that discusses the hottest political news stories of the week. And if it's an episode released on Friday, you know what that means. It's time for our news flash. We're going to start out with the Supreme Court, which put a hold on Judge Matthew Kaczmarek's ruling on mifepristone, the abortion pill. In a 7-2 ruling, the Supreme Court allowed the abortion pill to remain on the market, even as it's controversially being talked about within state legislatures and, of course, in national politics. The 7-2 ruling had dissensions from two Supreme Court justices. I'll give you 5 seconds to guess who those two justices were. And if you thought those two justices were Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas, congratulations, you win no money, because if there's two dissensions and only two dissensions from the right, you can guarantee those two justices will be dissenting. Although I found it interesting that Justice Alito, in his dissent, basically said that Biden was going to ignore the Supreme Court's ruling anyway on mifepristone if the Supreme Court allowed Kaczmarek's ruling to stay. Kaczmarek's ruling was that the approval by the FDA of the abortion pill would have been suspended, therefore being taken off the market. This has been painted as a huge win for abortion rights activists, although the fight, of course, is not over, as we will get to later in the broadcast. Coming up next, down to the White House, and it's been on top of a lot of people's minds. Joe Biden is running for re-election. There were some people that thought he might not run due to his age. You know, he is the oldest ever elected president. I mean, I believe he's around 80 years old, for the love of God. And some people thought that he would let Vice President Kamala Harris take his place on the ticket. Now, if President Biden is incapacitated, or the worst case scenario, dies, then maybe that could happen, with Vice President Harris being on the presidential side of things. Maybe she picks someone like Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg to be a vice president. But those are hypotheticals. What is true is that Joe Biden is running for re-election, and something that came up to me the day before he announced, or a couple of days before he announced, was that he appointed a senior White House advisor by the name of Julie Chavez Rodriguez as his campaign manager. Not only does this signal to me that maybe the Biden campaign will be focusing more on Latino voters in last election, where they may have sort of forgotten about Latino voters, and that may have partially led to Trump's gains with them, particularly in the states of Florida and Texas, and to a lesser extent, the swing state of Nevada. I mean, Democrats will especially want to recover their votes with Latinos if they want any shot of either flipping Texas or making it highly competitive. Spoilers, that's going to be tomorrow's episode, looking at where Texas is politically and the cases for and against Democrats being very highly competitive in the state. It'll be an interesting episode. Anyway, she's also the granddaughter of Cesar Chavez, the famous United Farm Workers leader and labor rights activist for migrant workers, so there's also that part to play as well. And Joe Biden is widely expected to win every state and, of course, easily breeze past his primary. The DNC announced there will be no presidential debates. I mean, they didn't do it for, you know, Jimmy Carter when he was coming up against Ted Kennedy. I mean, GOP certainly didn't do it for Donald Trump in 2020, so, it is continuing a trend. Although many people blast the DNC for not giving figures like RFK Jr. and Marianne Williamson the chance to debate the current president. And while there is merit to those arguments, I will say, once again, there is a disclaimer that, you know, the opinions I say here do not reflect the opinions of WVUA. You have to understand where the DNC is coming from as well, because they don't want to give anybody any chance to further weaken the incumbent president from an electoral standpoint. Right now, the president is favored to win re-election, likely over former President Donald Trump in a rehash of 2020. But, I mean, this is not at all guaranteed. Like, I say that Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia are all favored to go to the incumbent president, Joe Biden, again. But again, that is not a guarantee whatsoever. Georgia and Arizona and Wisconsin especially were extremely close, and Nevada didn't budge at all from 2016. Like, Nevada only went blue by about 2.5 points. So Republicans still see opportunities in those states, even if Arizona and Georgia seem to be trending left with their major metro areas of Phoenix and Atlanta. But again, not a guarantee. So you have to understand where the DNC is coming from when they decide we're not going to do any debates. And something else that was interesting to me in the response to Biden's reelection bid is that the RNC came out with an ad immediately afterwards, and they made it entirely with AI. Like, there's been constant debates about, you know, the development of AI. I mean, we hear these AI rappers, like one of the famous ones that came out, you know, we have an AI thing on YouTube where Joe Biden and Barack Obama rap Boys a Liar by Pink Pantheress and Ice Spice. Like, like, you just see the advancement of AI growing month after month, year after year. Now the RNC is using AI images, solely AI images, to make their ads is something that is very interesting and something that can open up a lot of legal holes and questions over the coming years, especially in the lead up to the actual general election in 2024. So something that'll be very interesting to see in the months and, you know, over a year ahead. Moving on now to this state in Alabama, and state lawmakers looking to add an 30 additional optional days to the school calendar. Representative Terry Collins, a Republican from Decatur, and Representative Danny Garrett, a Republican from Trustville, are sponsoring a bill that could add those 30 optional days of instruction for public schools. Currently in this state, we are required to have 180 days of instruction per year. If this bill passes, school boards would have the choice to add up to another 30 days on top of that. These extra days, says Representative Collins, will not be mandated, but she says that, quote, it would definitely improve achievement with students overall with less time. This bill doesn't mandate anything. It simply allows for you to modify a calendar to fit what, quote, your system thinks will work best for students. She hopes if the bill is passed, it will help combat student learning loss during the summer. She says with less time to sit at home, students will have a better chance of retaining what they learned from the previous school year. Schools that opt in the extra days will be able to apply for a grant that covers the cost of everything. We'll see. You know, the bill's currently in committee, and it'll be interesting to see if it makes it out there and if this actually passes and signs into law, what impact that would have for schools across the state. Would this actually help learning outcomes for students, especially in underfunded and impoverished schools? We'll just have to see. But speaking of, we'll go back to 2024, and former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson announced his bid for president. Oh, man. Oh, Lord Asa Hutchinson. Oh, man. Man. That's my reaction to his candidacy. Just, he's going to perform worse than Vivek Ramaswamy. Like, if you're going to perform worse than Vivek, you don't have a chance to get the Republican nomination, especially not in 2024, when you have the former president that is still very popular within his party, and you have a culture warrior governor of Florida that is also expected to announce in about 3 weeks, because it was reported by NBC News that Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to announce his campaign in mid-May. That'd be about 3 weeks or so. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, if, now, I already said my piece on Ron DeSantis and what I think of his chances to run of getting the presidency are, they're even worse for Asa Hutchinson. Like, look, well over half the country, probably over three quarters of the country, they don't even know who you are. If that's the case, then you're not really starting out in the best position, especially if you're trying to run against Donald Trump, which is what former Governor Hutchinson has been trying to do. That's not going to work. may have worked in the Republican Party of, let's say, you know, 10 years ago, but this is not the Republican Party of 10 years ago. This is the Republican Party of 2023. And Asa Hutchinson, man. Man, speaking of governors, Governor Jim Justice, the Republican from West Virginia, has officially filed to run for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by conservative Democratic incumbent Joe Manchin. Jim Justice will be having to face a primary, probably from Representative Alex Mooney, who represents, I believe, the 2nd District in Congress, the northern part of West Virginia. For those not clear, Alex Mooney, he defeated Representative David McKillian in the incumbent primary in 2020 because West Virginia lost the district due to reapportionment, and it went from 3 districts to 2 districts. McKinley and Mooney were double bunked, and Mooney pretty easily cleared David McKinley in that primary. But with Jim Justice's entering the race, that will set up a battle between the Club for Growth, who will be backing Representative Mooney most likely, and there will also be the Senate Leadership Fund, headed by Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who will be backing Governor Justice. My opinion on the race is that Jim Justice is going to pretty easily clear the primary, and that Jim Justice will pretty easily defeat Joe Manchin by well over 20 points. Like, you have to remember, this state voted for Donald Trump by over 40 points in 2020, with Joe Manchin running in a presidential year where West Virginia ain't going to get that much bluer, let me be completely honest. It does not spell good news for Joe Manchin, especially with the decline of ticket splitting and elections becoming far more federalized during the Trump era than we have seen over the past, you know, God knows how many years, past several decades even. So there's my piece. Jim Justice should easily win the primary. You know, some people may think Representative Alex Mooney might have a chance. He's got the Club for Growth backing him. They're going to spend millions on that race. So will Mitch McConnell. And with Alex Mooney being a carpetbagger from Maryland and Jim Justice carrying Baby Dog everywhere he goes, yes, he has a dog named Baby Dog. He once told critics to kiss Baby Dog's honey once in West Virginia legislature, so there's that to deal with as well. And I think Governor Justice, I mean, he's not a prohibitive favorite in the primary, but he's definitely a favorite there. And I think he's an almost prohibitive favorite in the general election. West Virginia's just too red to elect any Democrat these days, you know, even the ghost of Robert Burr. It's just not happening. And so there's my piece there. It should be an auto flip for Republicans. I say should be an auto flip. We'll see what happens. Politics is weird. I don't think it's that weird, though, anyways. Next, we go to the aforementioned Governor Ron DeSantis, who has been sued by Disney this week for alleged abuse of power. Essentially, Disney is complaining that they are being targeted unfairly by Governor Ron DeSantis and the Florida state legislature and state government, because essentially Disney is too woke, whatever that means. Still have no idea what people mean when they deride someone for being woke. I still don't get it. Disney's some of the best corporate lawyers in the nation. You know, it will be interesting to see if Ron DeSantis and his team can power through this lawsuit and see if they can't maybe win the lawsuit. But, you know, you're going up against the mouse. Like, I get you want to be this whole anti-corporatist, anti-woke culture warrior thing, but you have to be prepared for, you know, one of your state representatives comes out explicitly in the bill that essentially gave DeSantis power to appoint anyone he wants in the Reedy Creek Improvement District, which is essentially the self-governing body of Disney and Walt Disney World. When your state representative, one of the state representatives who voted for that bill, says explicitly that they are targeting Disney, that's not going to play well in a court of law. At least I wouldn't imagine, anyways. So we'll see how that goes. One of the other bigger news stories in the past week comes out of Montana, and it deals with Representative Zoe Zephyr, one of the first ever trans legislators in American history, and the first trans woman legislator in Montana's history. Of course, she represents House district in Missoula, if I remember correctly. And yesterday, well, at least on Wednesday, yesterday at the time of recording, she was banned from the floor and room gallery of the Montana State House and a partisan vote. Montana Republicans having a supermajority in the State House, they weren't exactly liking Representative Zephyr's comments when she said that, you know, Republicans have blood on their hands when they pass legislation that banned gender-affirming care in the state, you know, especially for children. You know, Zephyr attributed this to the higher trans suicide rates when gender-affirming care is not available within a state. And Republicans were pretty miffed about those comments. They call them libelous, call it slander, and they voted to censure Representative Zephyr. Now, she is still working in the Montana State House. She was not expelled, you know, unlike the Tennessee Three, but it does bring a lot of similarities. Like, Zephyr, on Thursday, she decided she was going to work in a public seating area and work there, you know, vote on legislation, watch debates, you know, work with her fellow representatives and whatnot. But, look, again, there is a reason why we have this disclaimer that, you know, the opinions that I say here are not the opinions of WVUA, but there are two fronts to which I will comment on Representative Zephyr's punishment by the Montana State GOP. It is an absolute disgrace, in my opinion, that we are censoring and expelling state legislators who go against the status quo, who, for a lack of a better term, are fighting for what they see as justice, what they see as, you know, as equality, and not exactly caring too much about decorum. Now, I know, you know, decorum is sort of a sacred thing. You know, you want to uphold rules and order and whatnot, but I just find it as a bit arbitrary, you know, determining what counts as decorum and what counts as going against decorum. Like, I don't know, man. Like, it seems to me that a lot of state officials, statewide elected officials in the legislature especially, a lot of them, especially on the more conservative side, and correct me if I am being way off base here, but seems to me that a lot of them are trying to use any excuse they can to punish or expel people that they don't like. Like, it is not lost on me that the Montana Republicans voted to censure Representative Zephyr, who is a trans woman. It is like that is not lost on me. And the fact that you're essentially denying about 10,000 Montana residents, because that is the average population of a state house district in Montana, about 100. There are 100, I think. There are 199 house districts in Montana, and there's about 10,000 people for each. Like, if you're going to do that, if you're going to remove a representative from the House floor or expel them altogether, you better have a pretty good reason as to why you're doing this. And with Montana and Tennessee GOPs, they did not. They essentially, from what I understand and have read of these situations, like, these people were expelled for essentially protesting against what they viewed as injustice, with Representatives Jones, Pearson, and Johnson, you know, from, you know, the Tennessee Three. They were protesting injustice in regards to children being lost to gun violence. See the Covenant School in Nashville. That had a whole episode about the Tennessee Three if you want to go listen to it afterwards. But with Representative Zephyr of Montana, it's about trans people. Trans people who are losing their rights to access to health care they need and the health care that they deserve. And even more than that, just denying the rights of trans people, gender nonconforming people, non-binary people, of living the lives that they truly deserve to live. The right to be free for who they truly are is something that I think we take for granted in this country. And seeing, you know, the attacks on trans people, the attacks on trans legislators, as this happened to Representative Zephyr, for being trans, you know, like, I don't get this hatred. I really don't get this hatred. And I also don't get why you would want to publicly punish somebody, like, to the Montana GOP, like, for, because you were miffed at some of the things they said. Like, Representative Zephyr said you had blood on your hands for all the anti-trans legislation that was being passed and signed into law by the Montana GOP. Like, there, like, a lot of other officials say worse things and say and do worse things for what it's worth, and they don't get punished for it. Like, let's go to Speaker Cameron Sexton, who has possibly committed voter fraud by voting from a Crossville address that was his condo, but he sold that condo. He moved full time to Nashville a couple of years ago. If he was still voting in Crossville from a Crossville address at the time and voting in Crossville elections, then that constitutes voter fraud. And Speaker Sexton has not faced any punishment for that yet. But like people who commit actual crimes, like they're not punished. But people that, you know, they might say the wrong things or say something that irks the people and that irks the people in power, and all of a sudden they get punished for it. They get censured. They get expelled. And I don't get it. I don't get it. Not just because in Representative Zephyr's case, because of the anti-trans hate that has been virulent within the Montana state GOP, in my opinion, but also because now you've made Representative Zephyr a national name. Like, it's the same mistake the Tennessee state House Republicans made. Like, you've just made, like, in their case, like, you've made Justin Jones, Justin Pearson, and Gloria Johnson national figures, especially Representative Justin Pearson, because now Justin Pearson is being talked about as a potential successor to Representative Steve Cohen in the U.S. House. You know, Justin Jones will be a name, like, if, you know, the congressional gerrymander of Nashville gets overturned, which will probably not be anytime soon, but, like, in the next decade or so, Justin Jones could also find his way in federal elected office or another elected office. He could move up to the state Senate. So could Justin Pearson. So could Gloria Johnson. That could also have reverberations for statewide politics. A more energized Democratic base may target districts, you know, in Memphis and, you know, in Knoxville and Clarksville, Murfreesboro, and other parts of the state. You know, and it's a similar thing that's going to happen in Montana. Essentially, now you've just ticked off an entire state party base, if you're the Montana GOP. And something that you really don't want to do when you have one of the most crucial Senate elections in recent American history, with Democrat John Tesser being up for 2024, one of the last things you want to do is give Democrats a reason to vote out of spite and vote out of anger. And you've just done that. Like, you've just fired up the opposition. That is something you don't want to do. Like, if, like, one of the things you shouldn't do as a state party or any political party is give the other party a reason to be mad, a reason to be upset, and a reason to vote. And the Montana GOP has just done all three. And what of Representative Zephyr? Now she's a national figure too. Like, she's nationally known. And there's also a pretty competitive House seat in Western Montana. Like, people don't know this, but Representative Ryan Zinke was pretty close to losing. He was within 4 points of losing in 2022. And with a midterm that had very good GOP differential turnout across the board. And Ryan Zinke only won less than 4 points. This is despite Native American turnout going off a cliff, because there is a sizable portion of that district's population that is Native American. And Monica Tranel did not do a very good job of turning those photos out. And she still came within like 4% or something crazy like that. Like, I will look this up right now for y'all. Like, Montana's first district, 2022. And I'll have it looked up, you know, like right here. Like, district one. Yeah, Ryan Zinke. Not only did he win by only 3.1%, he got under 50% of the vote. Oh, and guess which major city Montana is in the first district? Missoula. Representative Zoe Zephyr can now realistically, she can transition over to a U.S. House race in 2024. Against Ryan Zinke, whoever comes out of Montana's first district. Rumor is there's going to be a very competitive primary in Montana that involves both Representative Ryan Zinke and Representative Matt Rosendale is also some rich businessman, self-funder that's running and probably has the backing of Mitch McConnell. It's going to be a mess that I'll probably talk about more in the fall semester whenever that pops up. But now you've given Western Montana Democrats and all Montana Democrats, you've given them a succinct reason to be angry towards you, specifically as a state party. And with a House seat that is competitive, with an underperforming incumbent in that House seat, mind you, like this is Ryan Zinke we're talking about, not exactly the most liked guy in Montana. Oh yeah, and also a popular Democratic U.S. Senator being up for re-election, for God's sakes. This has a chance to severely backfire and have national implications, not just for Montana Republicans, but for national Republicans here. Like, what if this catalyzes increased turnout within the Democratic Party and allows John Tester to narrowly win? Like, what if the Democrats keep the Senate because of that? Like, this is just mind-boggling stuff. Like, the things that a lot of people will do just to get at trans people for merely existing. Transphobia didn't work in North Carolina in 2016. Pat McCrory signed the bathroom bill. It did not go well. Roy Cooper beat him as Trump won the state around, like, what, 3 points or something like that. And Roy Cooper, as a Democrat, beat Pat McCrory, largely because of backlash to HB2 in 2017. Roy Moore, like a lot of people don't know, but he used transphobia and anti-queer language in his campaign. You know, the whole marriage between is only between a man and a woman stuff. And it didn't even work here, largely because Roy Moore is a pedophile, but still. All of that allowed for a Democrat to be elected in Alabama. Now, rightly, that's made Roy Moore persona non grata in Alabama politics because he cost the GOP a statewide race in Alabama in the Trump era. How hard do you have to mess up in order to make that happen? That is honestly impressive and something I still can't believe. We had a Democratic senator in this state till 2021, for God's sakes. How did that happen? And the GOP laid off on the transphobia stuff because it wasn't serving them well, but they go back to it in 2021, 2022. They have a big win in Virginia based off this whole education, school choice, critical race theory stuff. Well, maybe that was probably because Joe Biden was very unpopular at the time and people didn't like him over the Cobb withdrawal. And, you know, they also made the New Jersey governor's race very close, Phil Murphy nearly beating Jack Chattarelli, but Glenn Youngkin became Virginia governor, and that did that give the impetus for Republicans to just start going heavily on the culture war stuff? The anti-trans issues, anti-queer issues, anti-CRT, and go up to 2022. And if you think that that worked for Republicans, just tell that to Senator Herschel Walker, Senator Mehmet Oz, Senator Blake Masters, Senator Adam Laxalt, and you get the point. It didn't. Now, admittedly, part of that might be because the best GOP candidate for Senate in a swing state was the failed son of a political family in Nevada, but still, like, this stuff does not work electorally for Republicans. So, just thinking logically, not just just putting the whole, you know, you're trying to ban trans people from existing and you will cause them to essentially commit suicide if you want to because you want trans people not to exist. Just putting that off for a second. Like, this is not electorally viable for the Republican Party. The majority of Americans do not agree with the new legislation that's being passed in regards to banning and restricting gender-affirming care, and even for children, especially for adults. Like, this is something that's popular with the GOP base, don't get me wrong, but is unpopular with the rest of the country. May that speak to a larger conundrum within the Republican Party, where things that a vast majority of the Republican electorate likes, but a big majority of the American public does not like you see with Donald Trump, with all these other issues. Yeah, and the Republican Party is going to have to figure out how to navigate this over the coming decade. But it just speaks, I think, to not just the petty authoritarian nature that has been creeping in a lot of state Republican politics, you know, maybe even in this state of Alabama, but it's something that I think is going to have some electoral backlash, whether it's in 2024 or whether it's in 2026. Oh, and especially, yeah, 2024. Yeah. To segue into my next episode a little bit, Texas is coming up. It has the only offensive Senate target for Democrats. Ted Cruz is up in 2024. And again, what you don't want to do is give Democrats a reason to vote. And the Texas Republican Party has been experts at giving reasons for Democrats to vote. I'm not going to say that Ted Cruz is going to lose. I still think he's a favorite. But look, that race is going to be a lot closer than a lot of us would want to believe. And a lot of us think partially because of this just not playing well with suburban voters and urban voters for the love of God. But we're going to end on three other news stories that broke on the day of recording. In New York City, the conservative Democrat Eric Adams, who's the mayor of New York City, had to essentially cancel proposed cuts to the public library service, which would have caused public libraries in the city to close on Sunday and would have caused a lot of them to close on Saturday as well. This is in the midst of a budget fight, you know, there being a budget fight in the U.S. House right now, but that involves debt limit. McCarthy got his debt limit package passed through the House in order to try and force President Joe Biden to the negotiating table, but over in the NYC City Council, you have a lot of pressure from the leader of the City Council, Adrian Adams, as well as a lot of people on the surging New York City left that are opposed to Eric Adams' cuts to things like public schools, library programs, preschool programs, and that they're also fighting for more social services as well, like you know, giving more half-price Metro cards to impoverished New Yorkers. And things like that. And that probably speaks to the NYC. And that probably speaks more to a surging New York City left. You know, what with DSA, Housing Justice for All, and a lot of other, you know, organizations and proposals and movements, especially, you know, I think ever since Bernie Sanders ran in 2016, you've just seen a revival of the New York City left. Like, multiple socialists have been elected to the city council in, you know, the state assembly and the state senate coming from New York City, like, especially around, like sort of, like, more northern Brooklyn, like, more towards, like, so, you know, like, from, like, so you have parts of Queens, like Astoria, western Queens, you know? Astoria from western Queens to northern Brooklyn, like, that area is essentially what some may derisively call it the People's Republic of New York. Socialists have joked that this neighborhood of Astoria is the People's Republic of Astoria, and for good reason. Socialists represent Astoria at every level of government, from city council all the way up to U.S. House with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of course. But, you know, how Eric Adams deals with this, you know, resurgent left and the demands for more spending on social services, even as he's trying to cut back on them, whilst obviously giving more funding to NYC police, which has been quite the controversial topic, and especially draws much criticism from the left. But that is a fight that we'll see play out over the coming weeks and months. Going down to Mississippi, in another story that broke broke on a Thursday morning, and Carolyn Bryant Donham, who is the woman who reported Emmett Till to essentially what could be described as lynch mobs. A group of white people went to Emmett Till and lynched and murdered him as a result of this. Well, she has passed away this morning. She died at age 88, and she had admitted she lied about Emmett Till, like catcalling her, wolf whistling at her, or something like that. She lied for those purposes, and she did not face any, I don't think, any criminal punishment for, you know, her actions that, you know, led to the death of a young boy. But a woman at the white woman at the center of the event that arguably sparked the modern civil rights movement is now dead at 88 years old. Finally, we will end in Nebraska. Something that broke within the hour of recording is that a 6-week abortion ban has been killed in the Nebraska state legislature. Now, an important thing about Nebraska is that it has a unicameral state legislature. Every other state has a state house and a state senate. Nebraska just has a state legislature. Just has one chamber. And this abortion ban that came up in Nebraska had to go through a cloture vote. You needed 33 votes in the state legislature, essentially what, a 2/3 majority or something like that, in order for it to pass cloture and go to a full vote. Well, the bill only got 32 votes because you had one Republican who voted against the bill because certain amendments, you know, that offered for more protections and more, you know, exceptions to the 6-week abortion ban, they were not included in that bill. Thus, the 6-week abortion ban is dead for this session of the Nebraska State Legislature. Now, granted, it's not to say that Nebraska, which is controlled by Republicans, not to say it won't pass an abortion ban, but not this year. I mean, the Speaker is not going to bring this up for a vote. This year, it's been held as a big win for abortion rights activists. This is also the state where Megan Hunt was doing a lot of the filibuster because of anti-trans legislation that came up through that state legislature. So that ends the news flash for this week. Tune in tomorrow where I will be discussing Texas 2024 and the outlook on how that state could vote, how it is likely to vote, and what would it mean for different parties to win the state, both on the presidential level and in the U.S. Senate race. Tune in tomorrow. Thank you for listening today. This has been Pulse of the Nation, Season 1, Episode 8.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.